here this afternoon. We have two matters on our docket for 1:30, and those matters are the first, People versus Hunsaker, and the second matter that we'll be hearing a half hour after that is a People against Guess. Counsel on both cases are present, I assume?
Yes,
terrific. We are well familiar with the facts of the case. At least one of us has been through the record, and so that helps streamline your presentation in dispensing with a statement of the facts. That'd be good. We have read the briefs, and we're familiar with the issues in the case. You have 15 minutes aside, and the yellow light comes on when there are 5 minutes remaining for purposes of rebuttal. I would ask everyone in the courtroom if they please turn off pagers and cellular telephones so that we aren't bothered during the course of counsel's argument this afternoon. With that request, counsel, you may begin.
May it please the court, I'm Norman Mueller. I represent Mr. Hunsaker in this case. The first issue goes to the viability of count two, which is the pattern count in this case. And the issue presented, I think, is a unique one, and that is when the prosecution elects a predicate act in a case in which there is a charge of sexual assault on a child, and then that election is changed right before the case is presented to the jury. In this case, it was changed at the impetus of the trial court. Does that constitute a constructive amendment, which is per se reversible error, or does it constitute a variance? Our position is that it is a constructive amendment to the information.
Of course, here the people tendered some jury instructions. I take it your position is that by doing that, that was tantamount to making an election.
That and more, Judge Graham. In the first trial, this case was tried twice. In the first trial, the prosecution made it clear that this was their election by several different methods. First of all, they amended count one of the information to cover only the incident. Those dates could cover only the incident in the motel. Secondly, at closing argument, the prosecutor made it very clear. This is our position. Count one relates to the motel. Count two relates to the apartment. Prior to second trial, they tendered proposed interrogatories reaffirming that this is what they were trying to do.
Counsel, may I just interrupt you there? Would you agree that there, in the abstract, there's no reason why in the second trial the prosecution couldn't adopt a different election? In other words, they're not necessarily bound by the election in the first trial.
I think in the abstract, I don't think there's any case law on that. I think in the abstract, you might be right. I would have problems on the timing of that. When was notice given to the defendant?
All
those issues. All those issues.
But it seems that just in theoretically, the prior election wouldn't necessarily bind the conduct of the second trial.
I think that in the abstract, qualified as your question is, I would agree.
Okay. So the problem here really centers on whether there was notice to the defense on this point and the manner in which this happened.
Yes.
Okay.
The other, as defense counsel stated, and by the way, I think the attorney general said in her answer brief that there were new lawyers for both sides at trial number two. That is not correct. There was one of the prosecutors remained the same, and Mr. Gavaldon was the only lawyer for Mr. Hunsaker at trial number one. He was the lawyer who stood up in trial number two. He had his co-counsel, Ms. Desmond, who was there basically for legal issues. Ms. Desmond made the record that she didn't have to do a motion to elect. She saw the proposed interrogatories and said, I now know, as it was in trial number one, exactly what we're defending against here. Count number one relates to the motel, count number two relates to the apartment. And so it was only when the defense made an argument as to count two, which was their strongest argument at the motion for judgment of acquittal stage, because there was a contradiction in the evidence as to what had happened at the apartment. The accuser, TB, said, I was not touched sexually. It was the mother, Charlene, who was saying, no, something sexual happened there. In the course of making that argument, it's when the trial courts, and then in conjunction with that, the defense also said, and by the way, we have two counts, we have two different acts alleged in count one as to the motel. What is referred to in the briefs is the oral sex incident and the penis incident. And the defense further argued that there was conflicting evidence about the penis incident. There were several different versions of that in the evidence. And they were trying to get the prosecution tied down further to elect between those counts as to the motel incident, or to further elect as to the version of the so-called penis incident that they wanted to present to the jury. It was then that the trial court suggested, I think you should elect district attorney, and by the way, what you elect, you can then move from count one. What you don't elect for count one, you can now move to count two. And that is the problem with the case. This is no different, in my opinion, than the HW case, in which a defendant was charged with a version of accessory after the fact when he was accused of knowing that someone had been charged with a crime, and the evidence presented at trial showed that at most he knew someone may have committed a crime. Our position is, and I do think this is an issue of first impression in this sense, what is the effect when there is an election by the prosecution and the defense is told, this is the predicate act that serves as a basis for this sexual assault on a child charge, what is the effect if that gets changed at the last minute? And that's a constructive amendment to the charge, in our opinion. Now, the Attorney General argues that, well, it's not a constructive amendment, at most it's a variance. But our position is that it is a constructive amendment, but even if the court were to characterize this as a variance, we think this is reversible error. First of all, it was preserved, and unlike in the Rice case, another fairly recent decision of this court, where the court found that a variance was plain error, here we don't have to get to the plain error standard because, as the Attorney General concedes, this was certainly preserved in this case. And this is the kind of thing that affects the entire strategy in these kind of cases. Colorado has a whole body of law devoted to sexual assault on children cases in terms of, and that developed because the prosecution years ago would file all of these generic charges, all of them in generic language, same dates, same elements, and nobody knew what they were talking about. Defense didn't know what they were talking about, jury didn't know what they were trying to decide, and that's why we have developed this body of law that requires election, if not election, special interrogatories. We have unanimity instructions. The Thomas unanimity instruction is required. So that the jury understands, here's what's being charged, here's what you all have to agree.
Judge Russell. Just want to go ahead and finish your thought, please. But I'm interested in this point precisely. Can you just enlighten me a little bit about how the case was tried in reliance on what you thought was the former election? In other words, your argument here is that even if it's a variance, there was a head fake. How were you misled?
Well, I wasn't the trial lawyer.
Okay.
And I do try these cases. And I can tell you that, and I can't speak for Mr. Gavaldon, but I can tell you that this is the kind of case that, number one, would have been challenged legally. If this had been divided differently, I certainly would have, and I believe Mr. Gavaldon and Ms. Desmond would have challenged, whether or not one can charge a pattern offense from two different events in the same incident. Go ahead, Judge Graham, I'm sorry.
No, finish, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to
interrupt. My point is, legally, there is an issue here, because factually, there was, the events in the motel were again disputed, of course, hotly by the defendant. But what we had was two witnesses saying certain things that happened in the evening and one witness saying certain things that happened in the morning. I would have, if I'd have known that those two events were being alleged to be a pattern from the same, what I believe is the same incident, whether or not they are separate units of prosecution is a different question than whether or not they can constitute a pattern offense.
But wouldn't it, it wouldn't stand to reason that if they were separated by as much as 12 hours, which is the case here, we have an evening and following morning, that those are separate in terms of time to such an extent they could be a pattern.
I don't agree with you, Judge Graham. I don't think there's a case in Colorado that says two events within one incident, if constituting separate units of prosecution, could also constitute a pattern.
I would agree with that, but that's you're assuming that this is one incident, and I'm suggesting to you that we do have cases that say that when incidents like this are separated by time, they can be two discrete and distinct incidents.
I don't disagree with you, Judge Graham, but that is a different question. The question whether they are units of prosecution and can be prosecuted in separate counts is a different question as to whether they constitute a pattern, because there's an entire legislative history about what is the purpose of the pattern offense.
Now, am I correct in understanding that your argument, however, can be addressed to the very situation we have here? I mean, in other words, we do have now these two events, one of which is the predicate offense and one is the pattern-enhancing offense, and yet you have not made that argument on appeal.
I have not, because it wasn't made below, because we had a head fake, as you characterized it, Judge Russell. I mean, this was not addressed. And then factually, the way you would have defended this case differently is TB would have been challenged very directly on her recollection and her recitation of when certain things happened. And that really wasn't the issue of timing, the issue of when things happened, really was not at issue. And the second thing is, this was not enough for the prosecutors when they filed this case to say these are separate units of prosecution. They charged the events in the motel as one unit of prosecution. Why did they do so? Well, that was, you know, within their discretion, but maybe they had problems with their facts. And that's why they charged it in the way that they did. I have a little of just 4 minutes left. Let me quickly jump to the child pornography issue. This is an issue that we think count two should be ordered dismissed. We think that it was an improper constructive amendment. We think a new trial should be granted on count one. And the introduction of the child pornography is one of those issues, and we've made a cumulative error argument based on the other two issues that we've raised in our opening brief as well. But this is a case in which the prosecution, which the trial court admitted, in maybe an unusual moment of candor, that she had admitted the evidence of child pornography to show propensity. That is, and what the reason, the way this evidence was used, was that if the defendant possessed child pornography, that showed that there was sexual arousal, sexual gratification by young girls, and ipso facto, it's more likely that that he was guilty of the offense. That is, that if someone looks at something or someone reads something of a purient nature, that makes that person more likely to commit the Sexual Offense Act. That is the primary purpose for which this was admitted. The prosecutor used it in that method at closing argument, and under the Hansen case and under which is an older case from this court, but I think the North Carolina case, and I think the name of the case was Bush, the court there addresses this issue specifically. Just because you possess child pornography doesn't mean you're a sexual assaulter. Just because you, and in this case, five images were admitted. They were used in the PowerPoint presentation during closing argument by the prosecution. Their expert testified ad nauseum about how much child pornography was there, how much adult pornography was there, 100 images. There were 480 images that were suspicious to him that had been deleted. And the defense had to turn this into a mini child pornography case as well. They had to call their own expert. And that expert testified, I don't think any of this is child pornography. But the prejudicial effect of that in a case which turned on the credibility of the witnesses is absolutely obvious. And that's why we ask for a new trial on count one.
Okay, Mr. Mueller, you've got about a minute and a half in rebuttal.
Good Good afternoon. Kathy Gillespie for the People. My registration number is 26109. I'm going to start with the election of acts as well, because I see this as a different issue. And I agree with you, Judge Russell. I don't think that there is anything that binds the prosecution when a trial ends in a mistrial that binds the prosecution to that prior election. The purpose of the election is to ensure unanimity of the verdicts. And in this case, there was never any question that there were three acts of sexual assault that were charged against the defendant. It was all three acts that were addressed in the first trial, and it was all three acts that were addressed in the second trial. Now, standing up here with the benefit of hindsight, I'm sure the defense counsel can think of a lot of reasons as to why he would have defended the case differently had this been raised, or had he been on, had gotten better notice before the second trial as to how the prosecution was going to elect. But the bottom line is the case law is clear that the prosecution does not have to elect their acts until the close of the evidence. And that is important here. The draft instructions, well, I couldn't find them in the record, and I may have overlooked them, were apparently, and I'll take defense counsel's word for it, were tendered and somehow demonstrated the original election. There was also a theory of the defense that was tendered. There were other jury instructions that were amended later by the court, and the defense counsel withdrew that theory of the defense, which was the same from the trial before, and amended it to fit this trial. Now, part of the reason why the prosecution gets to wait until the close of the evidence to elect their acts is because they don't know how the evidence is going to play out in a particular case. It can change, especially in a sex assault trial, which has been postponed for 3 years, and is dealing with a young child witness who, according to the therapist, had suffered from PTSD for quite a number of years. So in this case, there was nothing about the way the defense tried this case that was affected by that notice. There was a general denial. He absolutely indicated that this was the mother introduced incest, that he was role-playing. He never, absolutely never had any sexual contact with his child. This was not a case where he was indicating that he had, you know, came close to sexual contact in the apartment, but never saw the child at the Motel 6.
How do you respond to your colleague's observation that this case would have been tried differently on the issue of the timing of these two incidents that occurred at the motel, that there may have been much more critical to test the witness's recollections on that point if the defense had understood that these were going to form the basis of the separate pattern-enhancing charges, whereas on the assumption that everything was going to be just forming one count, it was not critical?
Well, I think in general, had there not been a first trial, they wouldn't have had that information anyway. And I think that's something that if they had looked at those three acts and had a question about how that election was going to take place, you would think that the defense attorney would have put something on the record and not simply looked at some draft instructions and hoped for the best that the election was going to stay the same. Second, I think the fact that these two cases, and I think looking at Wolhoff and Quintano, there's absolutely no there's no way that these two acts could be considered the same incident. They were separated by three eyewitnesses to the first one, no eyewitnesses to the second one. They were separated by an evening of sleeping and leaving the motel room. So if you look at Wolhoff and Quintano, there's no way that these two acts would have been structured together. And I could argue for the court why I think that they could both still be the basis of a pattern count. But the fact is, they knew that there were these three acts, and if they had not gotten something on the record indicating what the prosecution's formal election was or asking for a bill of particulars, they are in no different position at the beginning of the trial than they would have been if this had been the first trial.
I'm not sure that's right, because it seems to me they had good reasons for assuming that the case was going to be tried all along the same elections. I mean, there weren't the indications that way from the previous case.
Only the draft instructions, but they had also tendered a theory of the defense instruction that was incorrect. So I think that that is a very reckless assumption when you're talking about a sex assault trial to make just based on draft instructions. There is nothing in the record of any indication, and like I said, I can't even find them in the record. So I think if you look at this trial, the second trial, if the first trial had not taken place, they would be in the same position. And the case law is clear that the people don't have to make that election until after the evidence plays out. They could at that point have raised that issue. And it certainly could be raised in a motion for new trial and could have been something that was raised on appeal. But it wasn't. And what we're faced with here is a question of election which deals with unanimity. And like I said, there was no alibi defense. There was no different defense for each allegation here. It was a general denial. This individual was just flat out denying any sexual contact at all. And so I don't think that the theory of the case or the way they tried their case would have changed at all had this election been made formally. And based on the way the trial court ruled later on, it doesn't look like the trial court would have forced that election anyway, even if the defense had raised the issue. When they did it, the JOA motion, the court allowed, as it should, the prosecution to wait and to see how the evidence plays out before they elect the theory upon which they're going to proceed.
Ms. Gillespie.
Yes, sir.
Is it an oversimplification for me to say that what I hear you saying is you charged him with a pattern offense, and so he knew going in that any two of the three events could constitute that pattern? Or is it more accurate to state that you did charge him with the incidents at the motel as one unit of prosecution?
No, I think you are correct in the first statement, which is there were three acts that were charged, there were three acts that were defended against, three distinct acts that were all throughout the discovery, any two of which, and I have a caveat on that because I think this trial was 2006, so there may have been that 10-year before and after the way the pattern statute read. I'm not exactly sure off the top of my head when that changed. But in general, yes, any two of the three could have amounted to or proven the pattern of abuse. And I think the trial court did it the right way by listing the interrogatories and finding that one of the Motel 6 incidents had to be the basis for count one. And that was accurate because that's the way the dates were charged. And another notice to the defense was the dates for the second offense included both. It wasn't as if, I would agree with defense counsel that this was a constructive variance if count two had only listed February 9th, 2003 as the date of the offense. Then I would agree that the element of the charge had changed. But there's no amendment here. The allegations in the complaint are exactly the allegations that were proven. And the cases that defense counsel cites talks about cases where victims are renamed or the victim pool is broadened specifically. In other words, in the complaint, it charges one particular victim, and then in the elements that are given to the jury, it says another person was the victim of the crime. So in this particular case, the count one had a very narrow date that could only include the Motel 6, and count two had a date of offense that included both. And so based on that and the way this was charged and the way this was presented, both in the first trial and the second trial, I think there was an abundance of notice to the defense as to what the three cases or the three acts that they were defending against. If the court doesn't have any other questions for me on any of the other issues, then that's all I have for the court.
I really would appreciate it if you would address
Sure.
the 404B analysis. And my impression here is the court admitted the evidence for two reasons. One, that it would show knowledge, and the other, motive. And I guess I would like you to explain that for me. Why was this evidence properly relevant? And can you enlighten me about how motive here is meaningfully different from the impermissible propensity evidence that's prohibited?
And I also think that the trial court introduced it for the purpose of intent. And I know that motive and intent kind of wish-wash back and forth a little bit. The cases that the defense cited talking about pornography being relevant in a sex assault case, if you look at those cases, there's no distinction between the child pornography and general pornography. And I would agree with defense counsel that, you know, adult pornography may or may not be relevant in a sex assault case. But in this particular case, we had a much more detailed and specific evidence that was coming forward. So we have a young teen girl. The mother is exchanging naked child pornography pictures of the young teen girl with Mr. Hunsaker. The trial court, I think, did the right thing and said, obviously, if we bring in hundreds or thousands or however many there were of these pictures, we're going to have a prejudice problem. So we're going to narrow it down to five. And if you look at the five that the prosecutor brought in, it had to do with, and I'm not going to repeat the names of the websites, but it had to do with incest. And the names of the websites all talked about young teen girls. And in this particular case, the defense was that it was, the defendant got up on the stand all through opening and closing argument, and defense counsel said that this defendant had no interest in incest. This was the crazy mother and her sexual deviance, and he thinks that people that have an interest in incest are outrageous and bizarre. Well, in this particular case, I think it goes towards his intent because of the dynamics of this relationship, that this was this family play situation and it was incest. The pictures that were brought in were young teen girls with much older adult males. Some of the sex acts were the same, or the positions were the same. So I think it goes directly towards his intent and also towards the sexual gratification that they have to that the prosecution has to establish, that he has a sexual interest in incest and young teen girls. And that was his defense, was that no, he did not. He didn't have any interest in them whatsoever. And therefore, he did not sexually assault TB.
On this last point, mm-hmm. and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this argument, you're saying that these photographs show that he is sexually interested in young teen girls. Mm-hmm. And that is relevant in this prosecution involving a young teen girl. Do you have any cases that would recognize the legitimacy of that other act evidence for that kind of purpose?
I would extend that a little bit into and to include that it was not just in the young teen girls, but also in the incestuous relationship, because I think that's important in this case. I don't have any published cases that I know of that have directly addressed the question of whether or not specifically the child pornography and how it would be relevant in the intent or the sexual gratification. Not that I know of.
Okay. I would just confess to you that it seems a close call to me. I'm troubled by this, but I don't confess to not fully understanding it either. So I appreciate your help on that.
Well, I'd also point out to the court too that there were two limiting instructions given that told the jury how they needed to consider this evidence, and then again the instruction at the end of the case. And then I would point out for the court as well that they did find him not guilty, or did not unanimously agree on one of the three sexual acts. So I think that's evidence as well that they were not unduly prejudiced by any of this, where they just went across the board and said, he's a monster and we're convicting him of everything. So I think that's evidence that the jury kept everything in the perspective that the trial court had instructed it to do. If the court doesn't have anything further, that's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Gillespie. Mr. Mueller?
Judge Russell, let me address your questions first. First of all, the limited instruction given by the court was that went to knowledge and motive, not intent. The Attorney General spent a lot of time talking about intent. That was not why this evidence was admitted. And it is the North Carolina case that I've cited, which is one of the cases that says you just because you possess pornography doesn't mean you act. It isn't relevant to showing that you would act in some sexually deviant manner. Rather, the overwhelmingly prejudicial impact of that evidence, which establishes just that, that you are a sexual deviant, is why this evidence is not admissible. Ms. Gillespie said there was an exchange of dirty photographs of TB. Not true. CB admitted that she sent unsolicited those photographs of TB to Mr. Hunsaker. Judge Graham, back to your point, I think there is in this case, on the pattern offense, the defense was on notice from trial one that the pattern, be guilty of a pattern, there had to be a conviction of something in the hotel and something in the apartment. That's what was changed. And the district attorney said during the instruction argument and Case number two, we're doing this just like we did trial number one. And it was the trial court who said, well, why don't you move one of those acts over to count number two? That was impermissible.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mueller. And thank you again, Ms. Gillespie. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.